So today begins the third week of the Lee Rayburn Show, and it was in the very first week with the anxiety, my anxiety, riding rather high that I had this nightmare. I had this nightmare about not being able to get to sleep. What a confusing nightmare it was. I was sleeping, but my whole thought was that I can't get to sleep. I thought I'd just let you know that because this hour we're talking about sleep, sleep hygiene, sleep medicine, a thing we're supposed to be doing evidently a third of our lives, and yet how much of that time is spent just trying to get there. If you have questions about sleeping or ways to find the best sleep, you can join our conversation at any time this hour at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email to talk@wpr.org. Our guest is Dr. Timothy Young. He's a neurology and sleep medicine specialist at Mayo Clinic Health System in Eau Claire. And Dr. Young, welcome to the show.
Great. Thank you, Lee. Glad to be here.
So do you ever have any of those work nightmares? I've talked to everybody here, and we've all had those work nightmares here.
Right. I'm impressed you've only had one in the first 3 weeks.
No, it's the only one I told you about. So are we really supposed to be getting 8 hours of sleep a night, or does that depend on who we are or some sort of demographic?
Certainly 8 hours is the convenient shorthand, and that's what we refer to. For most adults, we typically recommend shooting for 7 to 8 hours of sleep. But that does mean spending 8 hours in bed so that you can get close to 8 hours of sleep while you're there. This depends a lot by age, though. Younger kids, of course, need more. And then as we age, we actually tend to need less.
Is there such a thing as too much sleep, Dr. Young?
You know, there's been a lot of research on that recently, and the studies show there is kind of a sweet spot in the middle, somewhere between 7 hours per night and 9 hours per night. But I do want to correct myself right away. It's really over 24 hours where you get that much sleep. In other words, we're perfectly fine with short naps adding to more total sleep time in one day.
Oh, nice. So naps could be a part of our sleep hygiene and making sure we get the rest we need. Is there such a thing, though, as being able to catch up on sleep? If I only got 4 hours last night because I was tossing and turning with anxiety about work, would I go back and get 12 hours tonight and make good?
That's a good question. The first thing is to say, how do you know you only got 4 hours? It's really hard to... It's really hard to count your own sleep because by definition, you're asleep for part of that. But really, we do know because a lot of us do look over at the clock and do the math. And so that provokes anxiety. The good news is you can catch up. We wouldn't recommend, going right from maybe 4 to 12 the next day. But if you slept maybe an hour or two extra, that would get you well on the way to catching up.
So this gets into perhaps the start of some sleep hygiene for me. So that clock next to my bed that I check out or glance at or figure out where I'm at in terms of when I have to wake up, is that doing me any favors?
I've thought a lot about this, and it's only natural that we all have that clock by our bed because they've been available for years. But really, you have to ask yourself, is it helping me? What's the benefit of looking at the clock at 2:05 in the morning? How does that actually help you? And believe it or not, and we can talk more about this, I'm actually a fan of the cell phone at your bedside that's dark. In other words, the clock's there if you need it. You can definitely hear the alarm when you need it. But otherwise, you don't need that light or the clock numbers overnight because, like you said, it generally provokes anxiety and scary math in our head.
Yeah, and that's what I start doing. Instead of counting sheep, I am actually counting down the minutes until I have to wake up again. But yeah. I think, and I mentioned it in the opening, that counting sheep is something long traditionally considered a way to fall asleep at night. Is there some logic or reason to that, Dr. Young?
There is, and there's always wisdom from our predecessors in the sense that, I hate to say it, but sheep are pretty boring. And so they're kind of a calm thing that you can think about rather than all the anxiety-producing things in our lives. And so a calm counting of sheep does tend to make sense. Counting anything really is fine. And in fact, there's some studies that show that counting backwards allows you to focus just enough so that you will fall asleep. Counting forwards is a little too easy.
And what's the reason behind that? And is there some sort of psychological switch that's going off when I start the countdown?
Well, I think a lot of us just have a hard time shutting off our minds. Our days are so full of stimulation that it's just hard to literally flip the switch at 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock and say, oh, I'm going to shut everything down now. We're not computers. And so we need time to unwind. And once you do decide to shut off your light and close your eyes, you do have to find a way to break that cycle that we all jump from one thing to another. Sometimes it's worst case scenarios, worrying about things that we can't control, et cetera. And so the best thing is to allow your mind to be distracted by a calmer area of focus.
Dr. Timothy Young, our guest, neurology and sleep medicine specialist at Mayo Clinic Health System in Eau Claire, taking your calls and questions at 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us, talk@wpr.org. Let's go to Mike in Dodgeville next. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Yeah, quite a while back, I have problems sleeping through the night soundly. And a while back, I had learned that 8 hours of continuous sleep is a recent phenomena with the invention of the light bulb. And in days before the light bulb, people would sleep for 4 hours. They'd get up in the middle of the night, tend the fire, make love, and then go back and sleep another 4 hours. So they'd get their 8 hours sleep, but they would do it in two sleeps. And I guess some of the ancient philosophers have written about the two sleeps too. Is there any validation behind any of this, or is this just another story I heard?
Dr. Young, the history of sleep.
You know, Mike, that's an interesting question. There is some data, some stories about that. It's probably not consistent, but you make a great point. In other words, there was stuff to do in the middle of the night, like get the fire going again, that people had to wake up for. These days, our furnace takes care of that, and we can stay in bed. And so there probably were things that you had to do. Likewise, you probably had to check on your property, make sure your animals were okay, those kinds of things. On the other hand, it is fairly impractical if there isn't some sort of artificial or firelight to get up and walk around. In other words, what else would you do in the dark in your cabin or in your cave if you can't see a thing? So I doubt they stayed awake for long.
Well, and when we're talking about light, though, you mentioned it in regards to the clock that sits aside my bed. Is there a ideal when it comes to the light in your bedroom and sleep hygiene, Dr. Young?
Oh, yes. Darker is better. Those studies have been reinforced many times, that the darker you can make it, the better. And so really, this artificial light is a modern intrusion. What's the best approach? Well, our street lights can be blocked with heavy curtains. Your clock really does not need to be bright overnight. So even if you have a bedside clock, I would turn it down as far as possible. Some people cover their eyes at night. Not everybody's comfortable with that, with those sleep masks. But in the end, you want it as dark as possible. Now, is there a caveat again? Of course. What if you need to get up and use the restroom? You need to be able to transition safely to the bathroom. And so you might need a nightlight down the hall, but that should be as dim as possible.
And the darker, the better. It seems to go back to somewhat counting sheep. It seems like we're trying to shut our sensory system down. We're trying to shut our brain down. We're trying to just sort of, turn everything off. Is that the best path towards finding actual restful slumber?
That's exactly right. So sleep is defined by a decreased or eliminated response to external stimuli. That means that if there's a soft sound, you might not hear it. But obviously, if a dog barks or if a child needs help, you can alert from sleep and respond in that regard. Likewise, with light, the brighter it is, the less deep sleep you'll get.
That's very interesting. What about other external stimuli that you might not be able to control? If you sleep with the windows open, you might have some traffic, you might have some trains, you might have some wildlife, as you mentioned. Is there anything that can be done about that?
Well, sleep really is a luxury, and it's kind of a privilege for many of us in the sense that not everyone can just close their windows and make sure all the sirens are far away. That's unfortunately just inequity. And yet we all need to make it a priority. So whatever you can do in your sleep space is the way to go. And we do control many of these aspects, but not all.
Dr. Timothy Young joining us. We're talking about sleep hygiene, and he's a sleep medicine specialist at the Mayo Health System in Eau Claire. And you can join with your questions about your slumbers at 1-800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org. So we've been going through some relatively hot weather, through some incredibly smoky skies. And I don't know how you see that as a sleep specialist, Dr. Young.
It's been difficult, and I think we can look back to our earlier in this year in May and June. It was really pleasant, and the nights were cool.
Yes.
And we could have our windows open. That was some of the best sleeping. It just felt good. You know, it does feel nice to have a light or even heavier blanket on. These days, it's uncomfortable to even have a sheet on, especially if your windows are open. And, of course, with the wildfires, you don't want to be breathing that outdoor air if you can avoid it. So in that sense, it is much more problematic. In the end, though, we close our windows, and many of us have air conditioning. And so that there again, you're controlling your sleep environment, and you can make it fairly quiet and comfortable.
Is there an optimal temperature to be sleeping at?
If there's one thing I've learned, that is a very personal decision. and we all know spouses, so some like it hot and some definitely don't in the same bed. So it comes down to the person in that regard.
But when it comes to heat, though, I saw this story from NPR where a study published in the journal Nature Communications found that the chance of having any kind of sleep apnea problem overnight goes up by almost 50% when it's 80 degrees Fahrenheit or warmer compared to when temperatures are in the 50s, that there seems to be a correlation between sleep apnea problems and our temperatures.
Right. And certainly we would all say sleeping at 80 degrees or warmer, it's more than just sleep apnea. You're worried about it at that point. You're really uncomfortable all night. You're sweating. Your sheets are soaked. You might have to get up and change clothes. So in that sense, again, we were talking about how some people just don't have the privilege of sleeping in a cool, comfortable environment. Below 50 sounds pretty nice, and I'm just shocked sometimes that my patients tell me they leave their windows open in the winter because they like it cold. And I think, how on earth do you do that? But they do it. I'm sure they're telling me the truth.
Well, yeah, you wrap up, you get an extra couple of blankets, you feel that weight on top of you. In fact, I've got a friend who uses a weighted blanket and swears by it if the temperature's right.
That's right. That's right. It feels great.
And why is that weight on you feel great?
Yeah, there seems to be some comfort that we can derive from that. It's not exactly clear. There might be more psychological components to it, but plenty of people like it, and all of us pile on the blankets in the winter, even if the windows are closed.
I am laughing along because I do like it, and I sort of miss it in the summertime, especially when it's this hot out. Let's go back to your questions for our sleep specialist, Dr. Timothy Young, sleep medicine specialist at the Mayo Health System in Eau Claire. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us talk at WPR.org. We'll go to Nan in Madison next. Hi, Nan.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. How are you? How did you sleep last night?
Well, a little subpar, but so my question is about sleeping in chunks, and the a man before kind of alluded to it, but I would love to get, you know, continuous sleep for 7 or 8 hours, but because of some medical things, I usually get like a couple hours of sleep, and then I might be awake for 15 minutes up to a couple of hours, and I add up the time that I sleep. And at the end of the night, you know, it's maybe 6.5 hours, and I might take a little nap. I mean, it's not as good as continuous sleep, but is it awful?
Oh, well, Nan, we don't grade people's sleep. We wouldn't tell you you have bad sleep, but, you know, you're pretty close to what would be considered normal. Certainly, we can all look back to our youth, our teenage years, even our 20s, when we got that deep, refreshing sleep. We're hard to wake up. We drag when we first wake up in the morning, but we know that sleep was very deep, and it was often full of dreams. As we age, that deep sleep, both dreaming sleep and that what we call deep sleep or slow wave sleep, tends to diminish. And that's what you're talking about, is that you're just much more prone to wake up intermittently. And I think you're doing a lot of things right. In other words, you're recognizing that you're probably spending enough time in bed. You're certainly welcome to take a nap during the day as long as it doesn't exceed, let's say, 30 to 60 minutes. You know, the only thing I wouldn't do is just keep counting the minutes every day, because in the end, you're going to get the sleep that you need as long as you listen to your body.
But I get Nan's anxiety, and Nan, thank you for the call, because I feel like if we don't get enough sleep, there are some real health consequences that could be a result. Dr. Young, tell us, I mean, with a lack of sleep, are there concerns about trouble with memory? Are there physiological effects? Why would we be concerned with, as Nan calls it, bad sleep?
Sure. And you know, these results are best measured when we have an objective disease like sleep apnea. In other words, sleep apnea disrupts your sleep throughout the night. And so it's not just the intermittent low oxygen that you experience. It's the fragmented sleep that results. You can't stay in a dream for long. You can't stay in the deep sleep for long. And the next day you wake up pretty tired. And we know those types of patients end up really having difficulty focusing, and their quality of life goes down. They can't enjoy things the way they normally would. Likewise, people that choose to restrict their sleep, in other words, you know, someone that's starting a business and really can't afford to work less than 20 hours a day, they are only getting 4 or 5 hours of sleep per night. We know that person likewise likely has, you know, impaired reaction time, and in the end, reduced to judgment. Their good judgment might not be as good. So we worry there. And then finally, and I can't underscore this enough, that it becomes a public safety issue. Drowsy driving is really an epidemic that I'd like to stop. And so you're putting others at risk as well as yourself.
Mm. And I don't know that folks immediately think of that, because, you know, if it only affects them, you know, I'll deal with it myself. But if it could affect others in a negative way, I think most folks would want to avoid that at all costs. But as Nan was referring to bad sleep, I related to that. I was having brunch with a friend this weekend, and he was bragging about his sleep score being 92. And Dr. Young, I was like, what the heck's a sleep score? And he pointed to his smartwatch, which is connected to his smartphone, which is evidently doing some smart math for him overnight.
exactly right. And we call that consumer sleep technology. And many, many more people are using this every day. Some of us find it really interesting in the sense that you can track your own sleep and see, you know, how you did. The problem is most of the companies aren't telling us how they derived that score. In other words, it's not a universally recognized score that sleep doctors would agree with. And yet the patterns are typically correct. In other words, you spent enough time in bed. Sometimes they can even measure your oxygen levels or your heart rate variability, those types of things, and estimate a score. it is funny when people start comparing and bragging about scores. Humans like to compare anything, don't they?
Well, I was just telling him about my nightmare, and he's like, well, I got a 92. Well, I have no idea what my score is, but I bet it wasn't a 92. Would you recommend you know, something like these smart devices? And if so, in what context?
They are a good jumping off point. In other words, if it does reveal a pattern that is worth bringing up to your doctor, then by all means, you know, if someone brought in their watch and said, oh, you know, look at this, last night I only got 5 hours, I'd say, okay, last night wasn't great. The problem is we can't see the long-term trend the way the patient can. That technology, that information doesn't transfer to our medical records yet. And so at some point, we'll be able to see the trends and make further recommendations. But like I said, they're a really good place to start a discussion. And that sometimes prompts us to look further for a sleep disorder.
Nan, thanks again for the call. Let's go to Jay in Two Rivers next. Hi, Jay.
Good afternoon. I've always practiced good sleep hygiene, but in spite of that, I've managed to get old. And with aging, although I can fall asleep readily, my sleep has become increasingly broken, but yet I dream during each period of sleep. So I'm wondering if that's a good sign. And my physician suggested, because Benadryl and melatonin and valerian root didn't really do much, she suggested Unisom, but it wipes me out so much the next day. Even when I take a half a 25 milligram capsule or pill, it makes me sluggish the next day. So I only take it in emergencies. So just wondering what you have to say about the quality of my sleep if I'm still dreaming, and what is it about Unisom that wipes me out the next day?
Thank you, Jay. And doctor, let's start with Unisom and other sleep aids.
Sure. In general, there are several over-the-counter sleep aids, as Jay mentioned. They all have a side effect profile, and you have to be careful. As he said, feeling drowsy or groggy the next day is a risk. And that grogginess can also put us at risk for things like driving, as I mentioned. In other words, if he had to go somewhere early, he'd have to exercise extra caution. Mm-hmm. Furthermore, the benefits are fairly modest. They don't really deepen sleep to the degree that we all hope it would. And then you sort of get in the habit. In other words, whether it's helping or not, you feel like you need it every night, and you feel like if you ran out, it'd be a terrible night. And so that's sort of not so much dependence, but just reliance on a pill every night concerns me. I'd much rather people try to exercise in the morning, eat a regular meal, avoid alcohol after supper or at all, cutting off caffeine earlier in the day, all those things that Jay described as sleep hygiene. So he's doing everything right. And we also have to recognize that our sleep is fragmented as we age, and that's a reward. In other words, the reward of getting that far in life is that our sleep just tends to be fragmented.
Right. It's not a bad result that you're still around and still sleeping. You're just got broken sleep. But are dreams an indication of a restful sleep, Dr. Young?
Dreams are very, very hard to interpret. In other words, we all had a night where we said, wow, I didn't dream at all. Or I was dreaming all night long. We tend to remember the dreams that occurred last in the night because that was closest to when we were waking up. And so it's really hard to interpret, whether someone's dream recall is meaningful or not. I'm sure you've talked to people that said, I never dream.
Right.
And then their first night in the sleep lab, we see them dreaming all night. And then I have to decide whether to tell them, I hate to tell you, we dreamt all night.
But do we all dream then? And it's just a matter of how many of us remember the dreams and how we recall them?
Correct. Pretty much all humans dream. It's a natural process, of course. It is probably the process by which the brain sort of gets rid of things that you don't need anymore and hangs on to the things that are important. That's why some dreams are so crazy or hard to interpret. As you mentioned at the top, some dreams just reflect our underlying anxieties, because it's still the same person in there processing what's going on in our lives. And yet there's dreams that make no sense whatsoever, at least not to the conscious individual.
What would you recommend to Jay as an alternative to, you mentioned exercise, avoiding alcohol and caffeine, and sort of wearing yourself out a little bit through the day so that you are a little more tired. But do you ever recommend any sort of sleep aids? And if so, what kind? Are there supplements or like melatonin or something?
Again, in general, we try to avoid either prescription or even over-the-counter sleep aids. I think we would say intermittent use is probably acceptable, that meaning, once or twice a week. Regarding over-the-counter, people like to focus on melatonin because we already have it in our bodies, and so you're just giving yourself an extra dose of what already exists. It tends to have fewer side effects. Some people see a robust benefit, and then some people see very little benefit to taking melatonin. And in general, lower doses of melatonin are better.
Jay, I appreciate the call, and you are doing just fine. And evidently, we all are, as long as we take the time to get the sleep we need, and we set up an environment that is conducive to that sleep, and we take care of ourselves when we're not sleeping. Our guest is neurology and sleep medicine specialist at Mayo Clinic System in Eau Claire, Dr. Timothy Young. We're taking a look at the best ways to get some sleep. We should talk more about sleep apnea, however, and what snoring means and whether or not that is an indicator at all. CPAP machines and whether or not there are alternatives to CPAP machines, and your questions as well about what it means to get a good night's sleep and how you can sleep better. You can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can email us, talk@wpr.org, and our conversation with Dr. Young continues next here on WPR News. So if we're supposed to spend a third of our lives doing it, shouldn't we spend a little time talking about it? We're focusing on our sleep today with our guest, Dr. Timothy Young, neurology and sleep medicine specialist at Mayo Health System in Eau Claire. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. And Dr. Young, I have a couple emails here. Let's start with Lori, who emailed to say she recently started counting backwards from 100 as soon as she lays down. She does it slowly along with her breathing, and she doesn't think she's gotten past 79 more than a few times. She says it works great for her, but the thing that I latched on in there that we haven't mentioned yet is breathing, and whether or not if there is a component to being conscientious of our breathing, or if there is a good ideal way to breathe in order to fall asleep.
You know, I applaud Lori for finding a solution. In other words, she's figured out what works for her. The counting down is important, but she's right. The breathing technique that she's found probably helps her. Once again, it goes back to what I mentioned earlier, which was, you know, just being able to focus on yourself, focusing inward rather than focusing on external stimuli. I imagine she's talking about deep, slow breaths, kind of the way the yoga masters would have us do. Uh-huh. And it seems to work for her. So it might work for other people, too.
Yeah. So breathing exercises would be a plus, but yoga masters makes me think that there is a meditative effect or component of good sleep, doctor.
Right. Calming the mind is the top priority. And these days, it's just so hard to do. We have access to all sorts of stimulation any time of the day, unlike the person sleeping in the dark cave. And so it really is hard to shut all that off without being really conscientious about it. In other words, choosing to shut down, shutting off the phone, or at least agreeing with yourself to not check your email, the websites, the sports scores, etc.
Which brings us to Derek's email. When he wakes up in the middle of the night and can't get back to sleep, should he just lay in bed and keep trying, or is it better to get up, read, or watch TV and make some efficient use of this awake time?
Yeah, Derek's on the right track. We usually say once you're awake in the night, 15 to 30 minutes max in bed is probably enough. Otherwise, you start to get frustrated. At that point, you can get up, transfer to a chair or some other comfortable spot. Some people watch TV, but again, 24/7 cable, there's plenty of stimulation there. And yet, if you watch a familiar movie that you know is going to, you know, what's going to happen and the romance is going to blossom, you can predict it, then that's probably acceptable. Likewise, you know, reading is perfectly fine. In fact, that's probably preferable just because you can control the light at that point. And yet we say stick with things that are a little simpler, maybe magazine articles, calm books. I don't recommend picking up the murder mystery in the middle of the night because you know you're not going to want to put it down. So make a good choice in the middle of the night. And then at that point, wait until you're starting to feel drowsy again, and you probably will, and go back to bed.
I'm still giggling because I just anecdotally, a bad book puts me to bed a lot faster than a good one. I know
there
that.
There you go. Something dry.
Janine emailed us. She uses two white noise devices, one on each side of the room. They also allow her 10-plus little dogs to sleep soundly, and she wants you to know, Dr. Young, they all sleep on the bed with her. They are her weighted blanket. 2 points there, white noise machines and pets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Janine, once again, has found something that works for her. The white noise is just a repetitive sound that your brain can get used to rather than intermittent sounds that are much more aggravating. So it's certainly a good approach. And she found that two is better than one, so why not? with respect to the pets, this totally depends on the pets. In other words, some people have a very calm pet that goes to bed and does not bother. And then I've had so many patients come in and say, oh, Dr. Young, I'm tired and my dog is waking me up all night. And I say, I hate to tell you, but you're going to have to do something about the dog, right?
I think we found your problem.
Yeah, right. And yet I'm a pet lover myself. I get it. If the pet is causing any sort of sleep disruption, it's probably not worth it.
Is snoring a symptom of something worse? Is snoring a natural breathing during sleep? How do you view snoring as a sleep medicine specialist, Dr. Young?
Yeah, I like to say snoring is a social issue in the sense that it's audible to the people around you. But as soon as someone says, I caught myself snoring, that's not what they meant. They meant that they actually stopped breathing and woke themselves up from an apnea. So an apnea is snoring plus a pause in your breathing. And the snoring is a clue that the airway is narrowed. And then the apnea just means no breath, meaning no breath could get past the back of the throat. A few apneas, believe it or not, is okay. So if it happens two or three times a night, that's actually normal. But the definition of sleep apnea by most standards, again, this is debated, is five times an hour or more. So you can do the math. In an eight-hour night, that's 40 episodes in one night where you woke yourself up. So that goes from a social issue to a medical issue because, number one, you're not getting the continuous sleep that you need, and number two, you're possibly lowering your oxygen as you do that. And so if that happens every once in a while because you had a bad cold, no big deal. If it happens night after night, that takes a toll.
So if you sleep alone and you woke yourself up snoring, you actually woke yourself up with an apnea, an inability to breathe. And if this wakes you up repeatedly, then it is certainly worth addressing. The most common way I see it being addressed is with the CPAP machines, which look like if you were to get in a jet, a fighter jet, it's the oxygen mask they would put over your face. It seems intrusive to me, Dr. Young.
Sure. I always tell people it's not stylish to wear CPAP, but it works. It works because all it is room air with a little bit of pressure. So I said the back of the airway is collapsing, and this is pushing or splinting open the airway with room air. And so as you breathe in, it's actually much easier. You do have to get used to breathing out against it. So that's kind of what takes time. You made a good point in the sense that, at first the masks were really not very comfortable, but now all of the companies that make CPAP equipment have gone out of their way to make it better for the consumer. So there's a mask that does go over your nose and mouth, but there's one that just goes over your nose. And then there's a smaller one that goes in the nose. And as long as it seals, that's the only sort of cover you have over your nose and mouth.
Oh, interesting. I saw a billboard the other day that said they had the alternative to a CPAP machine without actually saying what it is, which made me wonder, Dr. Young, are there alternatives to CPAP machines and treatments for sleep apnea? Oh, I believe we just lost Dr. Young. I apologize. We'll have to get him back. We are talking about sleep hygiene and sleep medicine with Dr. Timothy Young, neurology and sleep medicine specialist at Mayo Health System in Eau Claire. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. While I have this opportunity, I want to invite you out to the Wisconsin State Fair, where I will be broadcasting this show live Monday, August 10th. It's actually Senior Day at the Wisconsin State Fair. We'll have guests from the state fair there, and we want you, I'd love to have you. It's my first actual live show out and about from the fairgrounds in West Allis. It is Monday, August 10th, and if you could make it, we'd love to have you. I believe there was some confusion before where there was people were wondering if we were going to charge admission to see the show. We would not do that to you. It is a free show once you gain admission to the state fair. You can find out more details. Sorry about the confusion. It's like $17 to see the show. I don't think it's worth more than maybe $15. No, it's free, and we'd love to have you Monday, August 10th from the Wisconsin State Fair. We'll be live from 11 to 1, and you can hear it all here on WPR News. I think we got Dr. Young. Oh, WPR.org/events for more info on that. WPR.org/events presents. WPR.org/presents. Dr. Young, we were talking about alternatives to CPAP machines and whether or not you recommend any.
Sure. So CPAP does work well for many patients, but then some patients do want an alternative. You know, first I take a practical approach, which is to say a lot of people are worse on their back. And so I say, well, any way you can sleep on your side could be better. Even if you're traveling and you don't want to bring your CPAP, staying off your back can help. Likewise, alcohol tends to amplify sleep apnea, and so reducing or eliminating alcohol can be a good approach. In terms of specific alternatives, some people visit their dentist for what's called an oral appliance. And it sounds like a refrigerator, but it's actually just a small, like, football mouth guard that pulls the lower jaw out just enough to make room in the back of the throat, and the dentist can help adjust it. And then just two other newer treatments, and these are definitely something you'd have to see your physician for, your provider. First is something called Inspire, and, you know, the ad says treat sleep apnea with no mask, and it's true, there is no mask, but it's a fairly intense evaluation to ensure that you would respond to the therapy, which is more like a pacemaker with electrical stimulation to the back of the throat. Ooh. And it's been an alternative for people that have sleep apnea, really need to treat it. They try CPAP and they can't use it, and they need this alternative or a backup. And then finally, can I just add, you know, these newer medications that work for weight loss, and we're certainly familiar with all of them.
Yeah.
One of them was approved by the FDA for sleep apnea. And when we heard that, we thought, what in the world? Is it working on the back of the throat? But really, it's just reinforcing what we've told patients for many years, which is weight gain can make your sleep apnea worse, and weight loss can improve it. And with these drugs, some people lose enough weight that they can actually reduce or get rid of their sleep apnea.
But an easy, or at least a relatively easier solution would be not sleeping on your back. I seem to find it most often when I wake up sleeping on my back, but sleeping on your side or sleeping on your stomach, sleep apnea still be a possibility with those positions?
Oh, definitely. You can have sleep apnea in any of the positions, but gravity always wins when you sleep on your back.
That's come up a few times today.
Yep.
We are always in a constant battle against gravity. Let's go back to your questions now at 1-800-642-1234 for our guest, Dr. Timothy Young. Luke in Central Wisconsin, you're next. Hi.
Hey, Lee. Thank you, first of all, for taking my call. Second of all, I think you're doing an awesome job.
Thank you.
Filling in, taking care of the show. And I guess my question to Dr. Young would be, I've been prescribed trazodone to help with my lack of ability to not only fall asleep, but stay asleep. And my question is trazodone a safe drug to be on for a long period of time?
How long you been on it, Luke?
Right now, a little over a year.
Okay.
And I don't take it every night, but when I do, I definitely remember that I dream more.
Okay. Dr. Young?
Sure. No, it's an interesting question from Luke. And as we said earlier, in general, we try to tell people to limit their number of sleep aids they take, prescription or otherwise. And so I like what Luke said, which is he doesn't take it every night. And yet he sounds like he's getting benefit on the nights that he does take it. So it seems like it's fine to continue. In terms of long-term use, I'm not aware of studies that show any significant problems with that medication in particular. But, boy, any medication that we take, I always like to encourage people to, you know, assess it at least once yearly, if not more, to say, do I still need this medication?
Luke, thank you for the call. We'll go to Madeline next in De Pere. Hi, Madeline.
Hello. Could you explain what central apnea is?
Wow, I think Madeline gets the best question of the day. We were talking earlier about obstructive sleep apnea, for which we use CPAP, and it's just what it sounds like. There's an obstruction in the airway, and you can't get a breath passed. Central sleep apnea is much less common. It's just a small percent of people that have it, and then there's a few that have mixed central and obstructive. Central sleep apnea is interesting in that it's more of a central process, meaning coming from the brain. You basically forget to breathe.
Oh.
And in some cases, it's from medication side effects. Opioids are the most common medication that provokes that, but sometimes it's spontaneous or other health conditions produce it. It sounds scary, but in the end, it's treated through a similar process. In other words, you still need the air, and so we can use CPAP or some related devices like BiPAP to help you get the breath you need.
But breathing is an unconscious activity. I don't have to think to do it, so to think that you would actually forget to do it doesn't make a lot of sense.
You got it. The brainstem is supposed to keep you awake all night, but every once in a while the body overcomes that.
Wow.
And you have to need some help.
Madeline, I'm glad you called. This is the first I'm hearing of it. And how would you know if you even had that? Is it present the same as any other sleep apnea doctor?
It is a little different in the sense that because the airway is open, you don't tend to hear the snoring, but a bed partner might see the pauses in breathing. Okay. And then, of course, the next day you might be tired because you could still stop breathing just as many times per hour with central sleep apnea. And so that's time to contact your doctor and get tested.
Absolutely. Thank you for the call, Madeline. We'll go to Melissa and Cameron next. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thanks. Yourself?
I'm doing okay. I work third shift for 10-hour shifts, and I really struggle with anxiety on my 3 days off when I pretend to be a day walker. Is that common to happen if I don't stay on that nightly schedule all the time?
Oh, this gets to our circadian rhythms and how our body, I imagine, Dr. Young, has certain inclinations and how our economic necessities might work against them.
Right. My hat's off to any shift worker. That is, that's an added complexity. You know, when I sit down with any patient, one of the first things I do is go through their sleep schedule. And when I talk to a shift worker, it's so hard to understand. I'm like, wait, you work from 11 p.m. until 7 a.m. and then you do what? you sleep for 2 hours? And so I just have total respect for what they do. And,
yeah.
And Melissa makes a good point that, she's trying to be one of us. And so she tries to flip back, but inevitably she has to go back to work and be alert for that. So then she has to adjust again. So it really is tough. I always tell them, just do the best you can. Try to get as much sleep as you can in 24 hours, even if it's a, 2 or 3 hour block. And I'm impressed. A lot of them do have a schedule that works for them, and they've found ways to solve this. At the same time, they have to miss so many important events that I just really have respect for what they do.
Is there a connection, as you've seen, Dr. Young, between, Melissa's third shift and her anxiety?
I wouldn't be surprised, again, just because of all the social conflicts it creates.
Oh,
you know, she has to miss events or choose. Either choose to be there and be half awake or get the rest that you need. So it really is a dilemma that most of us don't have to face.
What would you recommend for third shift workers and folks who seem to be going against the circadian rhythm grain?
Well, it is surprising that some people have a natural tendency. Of course, there's night owls in this world that
sure.
just tend to prefer to be up late and sometimes all night. And, of course, some of them enjoy things like, empty stores. They can go in, and especially the ones that are open when they're shopping. For some people, it's a preference. But then a lot of times it's what's available, and there's certain pay differentials, et cetera. So, again, I just say do the best you can. Their biggest challenge, or one of their biggest challenges, is to find a place to sleep in the dark, right? So when the sun's shining brightly at 12 noon and they're trying to sleep, they really need to find ways to block out the light and the sound.
How often should I be changing my sheets, Dr. Young? Is there sleep hygiene advice on this?
Well, again, there's a wide range of normal, and it's kind of what you're comfortable with and what your bed partner might be comfortable with. A rule of thumb is probably every 2 weeks, if not more, because you wouldn't wear any clothes for 8 hours a day for 2 weeks straight and not wash them, probably. So that's why I say 2 weeks is probably the limit. The other thing is, what time of year is it? If you're sweating through your sheets at night, you probably want to wash them more often than every 2 weeks.
Yes, but your analogy is well taken and has me thinking twice here that you're not going to wear clothes, the same clothes for 2 weeks, 8 hours a day. So would
right.
you wear the same sheets?
Right. Mm. The good news is no one's going to see you, right, because it's your bed and they don't see your sheets. So
I'm not naming names here, but we did have this story in a social gathering recently of an old pillow that seems to have gained twice its weight. It's much heavier than it used to be. Dr. Young, do you have any explanation as to why that might be?
I do not want to speculate on that one.
Well, what about fresh bedding, the bed liners and new pillows? Do these things age out?
You know, I'm surprised. We all have had a favorite pillow in our life that we wanted to use forever, and so it's just amazing how much life some people can get out of a pillow. And yet, I've had a few patients say, "Dr. Young, I've been sleeping terrible, and I try to do everything for them, and we test them and all this stuff, and then they come in and say, 'I got a new mattress, and all my problems are solved.'" And so sometimes it really is just a question of upgrading what you're sleeping on. That said, just think about the wide range of sleeping arrangements people have in this world.
Sure.
And how some people can sleep on a rice mat and have no problem their entire life. So it's just hard to say on an individual basis what's the right way.
But I have seen some mattresses that look like a dugout canoe, and I wonder how that works. So
you got it. Well, I like canoeing, but not at night.
Jorge Imaldas, he loves to sleep, but on occasion there are nights where his sleep gets difficult. He gets really hot and feels like he overheats for no reason. He wakes up drenched or gets really anxious and feels like he's up all night. How can he get more comfortable in sleeping to help avoid this? And how does he get to calm down in a healthy way to get comfortable sleep in these moments?
Yeah, once again, that's a helpful description. If it happens every once in a while, we worry a lot less than if it happened every night or if it's getting progressively worse. That latter scenario needs medical attention.
Oh.
If it's every once in a while, it probably is a reaction to some stressful event. It's a natural body response to the nervous system to be sweaty like that. And it goes back to that sleep hygiene we talked about, recognizing before you go to bed, what stresses you're dealing with and what you can do about it before you go to bed. We call that worry time. In other words, an hour or two before bed, think about what bothers you, what you can do about it, and then set it aside because nothing's going to change overnight, right? Everyone else is asleep too. And so again, if it doesn't happen more than once every few weeks or a few months, just recognize that's a human condition. If it's more than that or getting worse, that's time to get it checked out.
So separate your worry time from your bedtime and make time to worry.
That's right. If at all possible.
There is some talk of making daylight savings time permanent as a federal law, and daylight savings time can mean that we can stay much brighter for much later. Does this have any impact on our sleep hygiene, Dr. Young?
It's up for debate. I think if there was one solution, we would have had it a long time ago. As a country, we kind of have to decide. I think the key is that we should all be on the same system, whatever that is. It's hard if certain states have carve outs. So I hope we can all agree on one system.
Karen emailed. She's heard that sleep purges the brain of unnecessary information from the day to restore itself. If so, what stage of sleep does this occur in?
Yeah, that's newer research, and it's really hard to sort out, what's exactly happening, but it does appear to be a process of, as I said, sort of trimming the tree, getting rid of memories you don't need, and keeping the trunk strong of the memories that you do. The deeper sleep tends to be better for that, either slow-wave sleep or dreaming sleep, and so the more of that, the better, and you can enhance that by all the things that we've talked about today, including things like treating sleep apnea.
Dr. Young, before we're done, what are your favorite myths about sleep?
I'm always impressed when people said they've trained themselves to sleep less. I think what they mean is they've gotten accustomed to be slightly drowsy all the time, and they push through it. Again, I have respect and also some concern for those people. And then it is funny how many competitions that bed partners have, which one of you snores louder kind of thing. I'm just happy when both end up with their CPAP machines and they sleep better.
That makes sense. But when it comes to training yourself to needing less sleep, that is actually a fallacy. That doesn't change anything other than perhaps how alert and awake you are during the day.
Right. We all have kind of an innate baseline. And some people really can get by with less sleep. They're called short sleepers, naturally enough. And then some of us do need more than 8 hours. And if that's you habitually, don't beat yourself up. Just recognize that it's most likely genetic. It often runs in families. And as long as you're otherwise healthy, it's nothing to be concerned about.
My takeaway here, Dr. Young, is this has a lot to do with outcomes, how you feel, and adjusting your sleep schedule for how you feel, and making the time that it takes to feel good the next day, and whatever that means is what you should go for.
That's well said, Lee. Sleep needs to be a priority for many of us.
I really appreciate your insight, Dr. Young, and I thank you for taking the time with us today, and I hope we have this opportunity to talk sleep again.
Great. Me too.
Dr. Timothy Young joining us, neurology and sleep medicine specialist at Mayo Health System in Eau Claire. Thank you for your calls and questions. Sorry we did not get to them all. Again, for that event taking place at the Wisconsin State Fair Monday, August 10th, where we will be broadcasting this show live from 11 to 1. Details are online at WPR.org/presents. That's presents. I'll get it right tomorrow. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to WPR News. We'll be right back.